What you got in your hand, Gio?
I have a conch, kind of a fancy conch, not the typical one. I forget what it's called, that I found somehow. But when I lived in the Caribbean, I used to make conch horns. Conch.
That's loud.
That's a bad rendition of it, but you know, you need to have a better.
So a conch is a kind of a huge shell.
Right. They eat the meat out of the shell. This is about a 11, 12 inches long, and it's not the flat one. It's kind of a curly Q one. And I came about this, or it came about me, and for 20 years. I looked at it and I said, one of these days I'm going to take a hacksaw and cut and use it as a
so by cutting horn. Cutting the end of the shell off and the actual shell being so helixial, I don't even know if that's a word. It's got its own hand grip. And so you've made a mouthpiece.
And it's like a trumpet. But what's interesting, I've been doing a documentary called Observing the Observant, which is about the ultra-Orthodox of most religions, but this one right now I'm doing it about the ultra-Orthodox Jewish religion. And in the new year, if I have it right, only being a part-time Jew myself, they blow a shofar, which is from a ram's horn. Wow. That they've been doing since the beginning of time. And so there was an event outside of Lincoln Center with all these people that a friend of mine organized. And it was around the world, actually, of people blowing the shofar. And I decided now was the time. So I cut the tip off, and I made it, and I found a guy who plays a trombone and a tuba. And I gave it to him, and he walked around playing it.
Really?
Amongst all these others. And it was the only one of its kind. And then I went to Borough Park, which is where all these ultra-Orthodox live, many of them, you know, Williamsburg and in Crown Heights in New York, and I played it on the street there, and it was really kind of cute and interesting. Mm-hmm. And people came up because they're very curious because they live in a very isolated community, maybe a lot of, and they're welcoming if you're not, if you're welcoming. And since I've been doing this documentary,
or if you've got a strange looking massive shell you're blowing a tune on,
right. And so I've been doing this documentary for 2 years now. It's on observingtheobservant.com. Actually, I made got a domain and put some stuff. It's a work in progress. It's one of my non-linear, non-story stories. Now, there's no beginning and no end. It's like looking at a picture book, or just look like how your mind works. Wherever you are is where you begin. And wherever you stop is where it ends.
That's interesting because we do get stuck in a rut when it comes to storytelling, believing this the linear way has to be the only way, the beginning, the middle, the end, or the set the scene, introduce something, pay it off. And, you know, Hollywood has milked this to oblivion to the extent that now we are getting kind of non-linear, super chopped up, freaky edits where you don't know what's coming or going, and then it kind of ties in at the end. What do you hope people get from your stories when they, I guess, have to immerse themselves rather than follow?
Now, interesting you ask that, because I look at most stories are a guided tour of your mind. You have a beginning, middle, and end, as you say. I look at those moments beyond the usual where people can actually just discover the wonderment, that moment. And if you catch them with that moment, wherever that may be, they're hooked. They'll stay with you forever. If you've got 1,000 hours, they'll nuance it because they'll follow you. Say, wow, this is really interesting. And if it's not interesting, you're not going to be interested anyway. So on YouTube, I may have these statistics wrong or off, but I believe from what I heard from the Pew Center, and I may have that off again, is that in the first 10 or 20 seconds, you lose 20% of the people. In the next 10 or 20 seconds, you lose the next 20%. So you've lost 40% of the people who have ADD, and we live in, you know, the internet nation is, we have collective ADD. Hmm. So we really have to be interested. Instead of making stories that have a linear track. Think about making a non-linear track that has no track and that people stumble along and they say, oh, that's interesting. Let me see if that, what's over there. Let me go look. It's like your eyes. Your eyes look around. You say, oh, well, that's interesting. Let me find out more about that.
The oldest case of this that I can personally think of, I think, is about 5,000 years old. And the book, The Tao Te Ching, which is a non-linear book, it's designed to be opened at any page, any time you feel like opening it. And it's a collection of 70-something poems. And exactly what you just said a moment ago, if you can get something out of that moment, and it's what that particular, you know, with their philosophy, it's like it's meant to speak to you inside. So when you open it up, you've got a question in your mind or there's something you're thinking about, you read a poem and it speaks to you at that particular moment. It's almost just attaching itself to the subconscious. And that's what these stories can also do.
Well, it's interesting. I'm old enough to not be 5,000 years old, but in the 60s, there was a lot of people who were looking at the all sorts of alternative thought processes, and the Tao, the Ching, or the was one of them. And so I remember watching people do it and thinking to myself, wow, you know, it's really interesting. They'll throw coins, three coins, the Chinese coins or some kind of coin. I'm not sure what it was. But what they would do, which was interesting, was that they would pick it up and they'd go to a page and they'd read what they wanted into it. So you read what you want into any story. So a story really, to me, is not a story. It's a moment in time that really doesn't exist. I remember Chris Brogan tells of a funny story about us walking through AP studio, you know, the Associated Press, and we saw these incredible photos. And I said, they capture a moment out of time that never really existed. You know, because it was just that moment. That's what photography really is. It's a moment in time that never really existed, except because it doesn't exist unless you capture it.
And Cartier-Bresson capitalized on this with the decisive moment, that particular point that when he was watching, he kind of had in his mind the before because he could see it and he knew what was going to be happening after, and he knew that this is the particular point that this photo makes the most sense.
But interesting, though, I've been doing some research because Henri Cartier-Bresson taught me what I do. After 10 years of, or many years of doing documentaries, I saw in a documentary on Robert Capa where Henri Cartier-Bresson, who started Magnum with Robert Capa, says, taking photos is like making love. And I thought, wow, that's what I do. And then I added later on, you have to love the people you're photographing. You have to love what you're doing, and whether it's people, places, or things, or just ideas, or even blurs. You have to love it.
Is that why the kind of non-always commissioned roving documentary maker always seems to be so much more passionate? Because there's a choice there. People say to me, what's your interview technique? And if you look at how journalists interview, you look for a nice location, you research the individual, you come up with a list of subjects, and then you question softly to start with, and then you drill deeper, 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 deeper until they pretty much walk off in disgust because that question was too uncomfortable for them. And I come from a school where I get to choose who I talk to, and most of the time, it's people that I'm genuinely already fascinated in, and I just want to capture a conversation. How can you not end up getting involved in a passionate, interaction if you love the subject matter and you're into the person? So I totally get what you're saying there.
Yeah, you know, to me, I had a conversation with Mike Lee, the film and theater director. He did a film called Vera Drake about a midwife. And they workshopped it for a year, and it was a brilliant film about and they had a talk with Mike Lee at Lincoln Center. And I asked him, I said, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker. What you've done is a documentary about a midwife in England as a piece of narrative fictional theater. And I said, you know, why didn't you do a documentary? Because in a documentary you're always full of surprises. You never know what's going to happen. You never know what the people... So you reminded me of a little story of a documentary. I've been shooting scientists for years because I happen to be an inventor in another lifetime, and I stumbled on these scientists in the basement. It happened every month, called Entertaining Science at Cornelia Street Cafe, and Raoul Hoffman was curated. Raoul Hoffman is a Nobel Prize winner in chemistry, and he did it with Oliver Sacks, the well-known Oliver Sacks, and Casey Cole, who's writer for NPR and long about science, and the LA Times. Anyway, so in comes Benoit Mandelbrot to talk about fractals. And what was amazing about Benoit Mandelbrot is he said, I had this gift of the ability to see equations, to visualize equations. And I said, wow, that's amazing, to visualize. Because mathematics was never something I could visualize. It was always something you had to memorize in school. So I said to him, I'd like to film you, because I've been doing this documentary, Playing with Science, looking at, because that's what I realized, that the scientists were full of excitement because they were like little kids in a candy store. So I said to them, I'd love to do a piece, a conversation with you in a snowstorm, because a snowstorm is a fractal storm. So now I have online, actually, on playingwithscience.com, just for a little plug, an audio, not the video, of Benoit Mandelbrot talking in a snowstorm.
Wow.
On April 1st, 10 years ago, 2003, I called him up, and he said, sure. And he called him up, and I said, well, it's snowing today. And he said, well, okay, come on up. And I have this 40-minute conversation with him showing me and talking about how he really relates more to trees. And the trees were full of snow.
Wow.
And so
full of fractals.
Fractal. And this is kind of, he's the rock star in the science world. Because without fractals, you wouldn't have computer graphics. You wouldn't have computer screens.
Mm.
And fractals, what are fractals? Well, you'll have to find that out.
Absolutely everywhere. Speaking of fractals, Fibonacci. Numbers, for example, this particular shell is entirely made of such beautiful geometry. Do you want to sound us out with a note?
Okay. Now, be prepared. I haven't played this in
this is the shell. This isn't the stomach condition.
No, that's not good.
I'll wait for the 12-inch.
Right, right.